Okay, good evening. Welcome back after the slightly prolonged break that we had. And we've come back to some very chilly weather, but hopefully the thought of Purim will warm everybody up because we're getting towards the end of the Megillah. We, last time, just to recap, in chapter 6, we spoke about the symbolism of Balayla Ahu, the night, referring not just to the physical night time in which all these events started to take place, but also it had a kind of ramification of galut, of the idea of the night of exile, and Nadadosh Nata Melech, and the way that the king is stirred, referring not just to Achashverosh, but referring to God. And if you haven't sort of thought about that over the period of time, listen to the tape again, listen to it online, and I think there's some nice ideas there. I think that was really taking the Megillah maybe to a new stage. But look at Perek Zion, we're on chapter 7. And this is already the, how should we say, we're in full flight as far as the second half of the Megillah is concerned. In terms of our program, I think we'll probably have maybe another 4 or 5 shiurim, and then we'll be making siyum on Megillat Esther. This week we'll try and deal with Charvonot, the very strange character who gets a brocha from every Jew on Purim. Charvonot Zocher LaTov, and the question is why? Who is he, and was he such a nice guy? As you will find out, he wasn't really one of our heroes, to put it very bluntly, but we'll talk about that in a few minutes. And also, a little bit of the historical background. Again, Rabbi Bachrach talks a lot about the idea of Esther coming from the house of Shaul. We spoke a bit at the beginning about the concept of Malkah. Malkah is the idea that Esther, at the beginning, ignoring Rav Lau's approach, but just saying that she refused to tell the King Achashverosh of her background for a very simple reason. Simple reason was that she didn't want Achashverosh to reject her as being from a house of kings. He just got rid of Vashti, and Vashti was the queen, she was the Yichus. She used to make fun of him, she used to put him down all the time, you know, sort of saying that I'm the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar, who are you? And it wasn't a particularly happy marriage from what we can see. And in the end, of course, Achashverosh asserted his authority over her, and she was put to death. So Esther keeps her origin very quiet. We said that in chapter 5, there's already allusions to the fact that the word Hamalkah becomes very significant. The beginning there, Achashverosh begins to see that Esther is not your run-of-the-mill young lady that he manages to bring into the palace, but there is a certain amount of breeding there, a certain amount of background. And this becomes very, very clear, obviously, in chapter 7. Between the first Suda and the second Suda, remember there were two parties. The first party, they go and Esther says to the king, "What?" The king says, "What do you want?" So Esther says, "Come to another party." So of course the question is, and this is really the introduction to chapter 7, why did she say that? Why did she feel that she needed to have another party? And the Mefarshim say, and there's a lot of commentaries say more or less the same thing, the first party, she didn't see any sign from Shemayim. There was no heavenly sign that things were going to change. All she saw at the first party was all of the negatives, all of the cards stacked against the Jewish people. At the second party, which we're going to read now, this is after the whole story of the king putting Mordechai on a horse, and Haman had to lead him, and Haman is beginning to obviously fall out of favor, fall out of grace, and Esther now feels that, you know, things are moving along. Things are happening, things are going in the direction that she wants them to go in, and therefore the second party becomes much more significant, not only in terms of her ability to be able to ask, but also in the description of who she was. She is now confirmed as you'll see in Pasuk Aleph, she's now Esther Hamalka. She is Esther the queen, meaning her background is established, her kingship, her origin, she comes from the house of Shaul HaMelech, and this is now not compromised. There's no hiding this anymore. Yeah.
This is in contradistinction to Nachshon ben Aminadab, right? So he jumped in. She's now, you're saying, she wasn't ready to jump in yet.
Not yet.
To see a sign that the mace is going to start.
She needed some indication.
That's,
yeah.
That's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is she wanted the king to be summarily jealous.
Yeah, and develop the jealousy, which we spoke about that. Yeah, we also saw that.
And that doesn't take anything away from her not expecting the mace.
Correct.
She made the mace.
Correct. Correct. What I'm adding here is something that, you know, I saw in the a lot of the commentaries on the Megillah, who add this dimension of, you know, what we were just saying in terms of why Esther did not feel comfortable to speak at party number one and started speaking up at party number two. But there's obviously the other element that we said before. But listen to this, chapter 7, verse 1. Vayavo hamelech v'aman lishtot im Esther Malka. They're now coming to drink with Esther Hamalka. If you look back at chapter 5, where the first party took place, and it's chapter 5, verse 5, Perek Chamishi, Posuk He, Vayom HaMelech Maru et Haman Lasa Deva Esther, Vayavo HaMelech V'Haman El HaMishteh Asher Asta Esther. They came to the mishteh, to the party, asher asta esther, which Esther made. In chapter 7, verse 1, it's now lishtot im Esther Malka. Right? It's not just sort of agreeing to go to the party of someone who may be on a lower level. This is to drink with, on the same level, Esther HaMalka, with Esther the queen, meaning Ahasuerus is now much more, basically coming to terms with who she is, and what she represents, and the consequences of that, which you'll see in a minute. Yeah. Well, he has so many reasons to suspect that the least that she comes from royalty, the Jewishness will be revealed in the next couple of psukim. But this is part of the revelation. Part of the revelation initially is to realize that she is from the house of kings. Okay, and this is going to be very significant in terms of comparing her to Shaul, which we'll do in a minute. But listen to this, Pasuk Bet. They were there for the second day. Right? When he's talking to her, even though at the beginning says Esther, describing the discussion, but here when he is actually being quoted, he calls her Esther Hamalka. He's accepting the fact that her status is of kingship. V'tinata in lach, and it'll be given to you, ma'apa koshatei, ad chatsia malchut v'teyaz, to half of the kingdom will be granted to you. Right? He's again, you know, it's interesting to sort of try and analyze what Ahasuerus is actually thinking at this particular moment. You know, he's giving her a tremendous opportunity here, but what is he really trying to do here? It's almost as if he might be slightly afraid of her. You know, he has fear, like we spoke about in the previous psukim with Haman. There is a certain fear factor, which we spoke about before, which may be coming into play here as well. But we'll see. Gimel. V'tan Esther Malka v'toma. So Esther Malka responds, and she says, Im matzati chen b'enecha amele, v'imala melech tov, if it's good for you, tinaten li nafshi b'sheilati, v'ami b'kashati. She finally comes out with the request, the she'ela, and the bakasha. Some rabbis say she'ela means for herself, bakasha means for others, meaning that nafshi b'she'elati. Yeah, I'm praying, I'm asking for my own safety, and then ami for the others, bakashati is my bakasha. Some say that's the difference between she'ela and bakasha. Okay, and it's played out in terms of the words. And now she tells exactly what happened. Ki nimkarnu ani v'ami lashmid larog labe. We were sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and la'abed, to be, how should we say, completely, to eradicate it, perish. Right? To whatever the translation is. Ve'ilu la'avadim lishvachod nimkarnu. Now she's going to try and put Haman into a bad light, because she said that Haman did this, right? The king of the moment hasn't asked about this because it's very strange, because obviously the king was involved in the plan to destroy the Jews. But what she's saying is that what Haman did was clearly not for the purposes of benefiting the king. Good evening. Why is it not going to benefit the king? Because the king could have made a lot of money. If we would have been sold for servants, manservants and maidservants, hecherashti, I would have been silent, I wouldn't have said anything. Ki ein atzar shoveh b'nezek hamelech. But now at this point, it is not benefiting you b'nezek hamelech in terms of what you're going to lose. In other words, by destroying a whole nation, instead of selling them for avadim, to make them into slaves and to make them into servants, where you would have made a fortune of selling all these people, what has happened is that we have been sold to the point of destruction. You're going to get nothing out of it. You're going to absolutely get nothing out of it, and you're going to lose a whole section of your population.
Like yeah.
Yeah.
You have to have something to get from it.
You wouldn't do this otherwise. And the interesting thing, remember the beginning, he even gives Haman the money back. But again, it's interesting because, again, the Mefarshim are very specific in the language. Ahasuerus's excuse of saying that I didn't know, he was involved in the original sale. If you look back at those psukim back in chapter 3, the only word that was used over there is la'abed. La'abed means to, I was trying to think of a good English translation, to get rid of, la'abed. But if I say in English, get rid of this, it can mean two things, at least two things. Get rid of it means, like you've got something which is nasty, you just put it outside. Or get rid of it means that, you throw it in the garbage or you destroy it. So maybe Ahasuerus's excuse is, when I agreed to what Haman asked me and what he wanted from me, I just agreed to get rid of the people. Meaning that the people should be sent away, but not to destroy them. Not to destroy them. And of course, this is going to be his argument, sort of a counter-argument in a way, to say that it wasn't me, but it was really all Haman's plan, and it was Haman's fault. Everything came from him. And to a certain extent, Ahasuerus can argue that he didn't know what was going on. You know what this reminds you of? It's just so frightening. Of the you read the transcript of the Eichmann trial, and all the time, his excuses that I was only following orders, and I didn't, and the claim that they probably didn't even know the full extent. He knew exactly what was going on. And he didn't fool anybody with these excuses. But the reality is that, the anti-Semite has always got a plan B to try and get himself out of the situation. That's going to be the whole story of Charvona. Charvona of Lao calls the opportunist, right? The great Hebrew word, opportunist. You'll see in the paper that I've got here. It's the word that they use in Ivrit. And being an opportunist, he saw that things were going bad for Haman, who Charvona was involved with, because he was part of the original scheme against the Jews, so he jumped ship. And instead of going with Haman, he goes now against Haman, and in a situation of changing his whole allegiance, he manages to save his own neck. Okay, and there's a whole discussion about why then Zachor L'Tov. We'll come to that maybe towards the end. No, talk about Harchavona. Chavona, this guy who told Mordechai, he said, that's the tree. No. This is it's according to some, he's one of the seven, or according to others, he was involved with Bigtan and Teresh. He was always around, this Charvona guy. And we're going to talk about him in a few minutes. But listen to this. Let's just get through the psukim. So now the cat's out of the bag. Vayomer HaMelech, Pasuk Hey, Vayomer Achashverosh, Vayomer Esther HaMalka. Two Vayomers, which is very unusual. Rashi points out. Vayomer, the first Vayomer is with a melitz, with a matargem, with someone who's translating, like an interpreter, right? Because you're standing in front of the king, you've got to go through a third party. You're not allowed to talk directly to the king. By the time Ahasuerus realizes who Esther is, Vayomer, the second Vayomer, he talks to her direct. Because now he's not going to go through an interpreter, because he now fully understands who she is, where she comes from, and what she represents. And of course, this is one of the significant changes. That's all in the Rashi here. If you look at the Rashi, Vayomer Vayomer, he talks about B'techila medabe ima al yidei melitz, I think he's, al yidei shaliach. He uses the word shaliach, but the Midrash uses the word matargen. He actually had someone who was acting as a translator between the person, or an intermediary between the person talking and the king. But in this case, Vayomer, Vayomer, he talks directly to her, which again is significant. And of course, his question is, who is the one who decided to do this? Yeah.
Was he speaking, speaking one language, less speaking.
No, it's like more just someone who is bringing the word to the king. It's very much like in the Gemara when they talk about Amoroim. What was an Amora? An Amora was a person standing up, not translating, but speaking to the crowd. The Tana would say what he said, and the Amora would then Omar. He would say it to everybody else. So I think it's the same idea. Yeah, yeah.
Maybe another explanation. So of Vayomer, maybe the first Vayomer he saved to himself. What is going on?
Yeah, yeah.
And then the second Vayomer, he started responding.
And then he was responding. That's another interpretation. That's actually Mefarshim say that. Vayomer or Dibel Atzmo, and then later, then Vayomer le Esther. Excellent, excellent, yeah.
Yeah, when it says, who is this person?
Yeah. Yeah. But again, what do the Mefarshim say? He says, who was the one who decided to destroy Am Yisrael? Meaning, who was the one who really signed the death warrant? Because he is arguing, this is how the commentators say it, that when I gave the permission to Haman, it was La'abed just to get rid of them. Meaning that, you know, we would exile them. Like Hitler did at the beginning. He pushed all the Jews from Poland back into Poland. All right, you know, on the excuse that they have to leave Germany. But of course, in the end, we knew that what his real plan was. Okay, that was the whole idea. And this is Achashverosh's excuse. It becomes very significant in the next pasuk, because what does she say? Vatome Esther ish tsar v'oyem Haman hara hazeh. There's a lot of words here. She calls him this man, this enemy. What is it? Tsar is an adversary. Haman hara. Right? The evil Haman. Why did she say Hazeh? So the rabbi's got a wonderful interpretation here. Hazeh, she pointed at Achashverosh. She was pointing her finger at Achashverosh because she said, she was about to say to him, you're as much responsible for this as he is. Because you signed on the dotted line and you gave him the permission, right, to go and destroy the Jews. A Malach came along and pushed her hand back to Haman. So that's why I had to say Hazeh, because in fact, if she'd pointed to Achashverosh would have been so angry with her, he probably would have killed her on the spot or arranged for her execution. And that was not going to be, that was not going to happen. So the Chazal here have a real play on this whole story here, that Esther was not going to cover up anything in terms of the story, in terms of the background. She wanted to accuse Achashverosh to his face. And Hazeh, what happened was that the hand was pushed away from the direction of Achashverosh and she ended up pointing at Haman. That's what the rabbis say. How they get this from these words, I don't know, but it's a great story. Yeah.
I understand. Why did Esther make the statement and say, Achashverosh, you're responsible. What's Achashverosh? He's the king. What's he going to do?
Well, I mean, obviously, she's looking.
She's sticking her neck out.
They're saying she's sticking her neck out to the point where she was prepared to die for the cause. She won. I know. I mean, I know, and that's the risk that she's taking. You're right, but the rabbis say that at this point, it's all or nothing as far as she's concerned. She can't bring herself not to express the absolute truth in order to sort of, you know, bring it to a conclusion. It's fascinating because you're right. It's like a suicidal thing to say. You're the guy responsible. I mean, you're standing in front of the guy with the gun. You're the one responsible. And he's got the gun in his hand. You're mad. But this is what she's doing here.
That's why she's not Esther Malka.
And you know, she keeps coming in and out of the Malka. And again, we're going to talk about that a little bit more. But listen to this. And of course, Haman is absolutely shocked. He's terrified. Okay, the whole thing about Haman is that he doesn't seem to have much backbone. But Hamelech Kamba Hamatan, this famous story, the king was so angry, he wanted to calm down. So what did he do? He got up, Minshtei Ayayin, went out into the garden, Ginata Bitan, he went out into the garden. But Haman Amad, Vakeshan Hashem Estei Amalka, Ki Ra'a Ki Katai Lav Haram Eit Hamelech, because Haman saw that the evil was coming to him, Eit Hamelech. And of course, if you say Melech means God, then you know, even Haman is beginning to realize that this is a story that he can't explain. One minute he's Alagova, he's on the top of the tree, and the next minute, wham, he's right in the mud, and he can't explain it. And he's beginning to understand that there's more to this, you know. Because again, if you look in Midrashim, you'll see that Haman was very aware of Jewish tradition, which again is very true of all the anti-Semites. They all understand Jewish tradition, and they used it, unfortunately, to torment the Jews as much as possible. And there's a lot of stories about that, which I don't want to go into. Chet. V'hamelech shal meginat abitan al beit mishta ayayin. The king comes back. V'haman nefel al mita she'estem aleha. And again, Haman is falling on the bed. The story is again that one of the malachim came along, one of the angels, and pushed him onto the bed. All right, because he was standing there begging for his life from Esther. And the next thing you know, he's fallen over. It's almost as if he's trying to assault her or attack her. And the king sees this, and the king loses his cool completely.
Did he actually fall?
That's what it seems to be. Yeah, he was pushed. Well, he was pushed. That's what it says here. It's fascinating.
Before it says Haman Amad, past tense. Here, no fail.
Yeah, falling.
And that's why Chazal say he was pushed at that second.
Yeah. Rashi says, Malach Dochfo. A Malach. There's a very busy angel over here. There's an angel who's doing a lot. He's moving her hand. He's pushing Haman. He's having a good time, this invisible angel. It's a wild story, this. This is a wild story. I'm telling you, it's unbelievable.
So the king comes back, and
the king comes back, and of course, he's not too impressed with Haman's behavior. Chet. And v'hamelech shav yigidat abitana beit mishta yayin homan ofel amita she'esteh aleha v'yoma amelech. So the king says, hagam lichbosh es hamalka imi babayit, you also want to conquer my wife with me in the house. In other words, you want to take advantage of your position with her, and you're being so aggressive towards her. Some say you even wanted to be intimate. I mean, there are all different suggestions here. Hadavai yatsa mipi amelech bnei Haman chafu. And at this point, Haman knows he's done for. His face is so long and so he's destroyed. Vayomer charvoina. Here comes this gentleman, out of left field. What's he doing there? Where did he come from? We don't know him from the beginning. We don't know him we have allusions to him, but we don't really see him. And all of a sudden, here he comes, the big hero. Vayomer charvoina chal menasari simlif ne'ar mele. And he says, here's the tree which Haman made for Mordechai. And Mordechai is your friend. And Omed bebeit Haman, it's in the house of Haman, this tall tree which is visible for the whole of Shushan. Everyone can see it. Go over 50 amas high, 100 feet high. And the king says, almost, how should we say, not even thinking about it, hang it. Hang Haman on the tree, vayitlo et Haman al ha'etz ha'sheichin le'Mordechai, and they hanged Haman on the tree, v'chamata ha'melech shechacha, and the anger of the king died down. And this again, there's a whole discussion about that expression, because it links back to the second chapter where shechacha, this is a king who boils over, dies down, and he's a very difficult guy to deal with. There's a lot of links between the language of the original anger and the anger over here. It's fascinating. And Keshocha Masamalek, we had the beginning. Let me show you this page, because this is really a lot of fun. A lot to say about this chapter, even though it's a very small chapter, there's unbelievable stuff going on here. Yeah. Well, again, that's I think in Persia, as the Farshim explained, that was the symbol of, the death sentence. I mean, different societies. This is it. You're done for. I mean, in England, they used to put on the black cap to announce the death sentence. So I suppose in Persia, maybe that's what they did. They would cover his face because it was as if he was already dead. He was gone. Thank you. Have a look at this. I've just copied out a few items from Rabbi Bachra, and on the back page a bit of Rav Lau on Charvona. Section A, which is very, very precious, because again, once Esther reveals who she is and that she's from the house of Shaul, there is an intrinsic connection between Esther and Shaul in terms of behavior. And what Rav Bachra wants to point out, I like this because this takes us back to our learning of Sefer Shmuel, which we did a number of years ago, but it's one of those things that I like sort of referring back to that. Listen to this, it's in the middle of the section A, Bat Melachim, where it's underlined. Bat Melachim Ana, she says, I am the daughter of kings, Mibet Shaul Katina, she says to him, I'm from the house of Shaul. And says the commentary here, it's taken from the Gemara, there was a tremendous sense of sniut in the tradition of the family going right back to Rachel. So initially Rachel had the zechut that she would eventually have someone who would descend from her, who would also be excel in sniut. Now, I talk about sniut. I talk about this at Stone College all the time because it drives me nuts. The whole emphasis in the moment, mention the word sniut, then it's all about clothing. And all of a sudden, you get into a whole discussion of lengths of skirts. And all right, you know, it's part of sniut, fine. But it's not what sniut's really about. Sniut here is about behavior. It's about your, you know, who you are as a human being. How you present yourself, how you, how you are as a human being in terms of your interaction with the rest of the world. How modest are you in terms of what you do? Why is Shaul considered to be such a modest person? And he explains over here. Second line, B'schat sniut shaitaba b'Shaul, and the modesty of Shaul, Zacha v'yatza b'menu Esther. Esther was descended from Shaul. So what's it all about? V'amar Rebbe Loza, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu posted gedula la'adam. Ah, so I'm not going to go through that one. Go to the next paragraph. Ma'at sniut shaitaba b'Shaul. So what are we talking about? Modesty of Shaul. Dichtib, because it says there's a whole story there in chapter 10 when he's looking for the donkeys, he's looking for the animals. You remember, he's running around, his father told him to go and look for them, and of course, in the process of looking for the animals, he's anointed as the king. So when he goes home and he's asked, did you find the animals? He forgot to mention, oh, by the way, I just became the king of Israel. He kept it quiet. And Shaul was a very modest man, and this is what he refers to here. Vayomer Dod Shaul, it's not David, Dod Shaul, the uncle of Shaul said, Haginan Ali Ma Malachem Shmuel. He wants to know, what did Shmuel say to you? Vayomer Shaul Dodo, so Shmuel said to his uncle, Haged Higidlanu ki nimtzu atonot. He told me that the animals were found that he was looking for. Ve'et devar melucha lo higidlo. And he didn't tell him, by the way, I just became the king. Right, Asher Amar Shmuel, which Shmuel had said to him. So Zacha, because of that modesty that he didn't want to announce, because you know he was a very humble person. Zacha v'yatza mimenu Esther. That's why he merited Esther dichtiv, because it says about Esther, Lo yigid Esther tamavad moladata. She kept her mouth shut. Didn't Mordechai said, "Don't say who you are, where you come from," and she obeyed the command of Mordechai, even though, as Reb Bachrach says, it must have given her tremendous pain to do so. You know, there were certain points where she just had to zip, had to button her lip, as it were, and she wanted to speak, she wanted to say something, and she couldn't do so. Listen to this. Kushal came Esther. It's about three quarters of the way down where you've got a little star on the right-hand side again. Kushal came Esther. As with Shaul, so with Esther. What does that mean? Harbei zman haita Esther kemachrisha. Esther was silent. V'savla b'kirba, she suffered from within. Et sevel shivya u'bizyona, she felt so abused and so put down because of where she was. V'lo yigid et amavet moladata, she didn't talk about where she comes from. V'od harbe zman haita mukhana lachrish, and she was prepared to be silent even more. She says, I would have been quiet if we'd just been sold as slaves. I wouldn't have said anything about who I am. Right? That's what she just said. We just read that in the pasuk. She was going to be continue to be silent. But Esther now had to stand up and fight and make a statement. That's when she literally put on the clothing of majesty of her father's house, the house of Shaul, and she cried out. Ki kein tzivaleh Mordechai beit azot, and this is what Mordechai had said, ki amachareish tachrishi beit azot, if you will be silent, then there'll be a help from somewhere else. In other words, Esther now understood, this is the moment, this is the time to shout out. So what Rebecca points out so beautifully is that the story of Esther not revealing who she is really a character trait. It's not just her obeying her uncle's command, but it comes from within. It's part of her chayin, part of her specialness as a descendant of this very special individual, the first king of Israel, Shaul HaMelech. I just like that. I like that idea.
This,
yeah.
This is opposite Rabbi Lazar.
Correct. As I said, we're going to put Rabbi Lau's opinion to one side. I mean, what comes out of this is that there are clearly two approaches to this story, the more traditional approach, and then the more what we call the historical approach. And Rav Lau is very much in the process of the historical approach, and what we're following now is more what I call the more traditional approach. Are they both compatible? The answer is that they're looking at it from different different angles, right? Where is the truth? Maybe somewhere in the middle, who knows? And I'm going to talk about that. I'm speaking at YU on the 9th of March in the Sunday program, and that's part of what I'm going to discuss. Hopefully the Olam there won't kill me too much over it. We'll see what happens when we get there. But I want to talk about that because it's kind of interesting that you can have two very distinct approaches with two very different definitions of who Esther is. And that I find fascinating. Because the second, this definition we're very comfortable with, the other definition is a wow. And it's come out of nowhere. And it's possible. Who knows? It is possible. But it does create kind of tensions when we learn this section of the story. All right. Have a look at this. I'm going to jump to Charvon. I'm just looking at the time. We have a few minutes. If you go over to the back of the page, there is a very amazing, I mean, only word to describe it, there are amazing midrashim about Charvona, that when he comes literally out of nowhere, who exactly is he? And of course the rabbis, if already they're talking about angels pushing here and pushing there, you can already have Charvona, being really an Eliyahu HaNavi character, all right? In case you were worried about that. I'll just show this to you because I had to print this out. And it's on the page 2 on the right hand side, about a third of the way down. Haderech Hashniya hi derech hanes. There is a miracle going on here with Charvona. What's the miracle? Boto sha'a. This is a quote from Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, one of the old midrashic texts. He says, Boto sha'a ba Eliyahu zachor latov. Elijah appeared v'nidmeh leCharvona, and he looked like Charvona. A Charvona lookalike. Who knew? Echad misarisei hamelech, and Charvona was recognized as one of the king's officers. Amala, and Eliyahu says, Yesh eitz bebeito shel Haman. There's a tree over there. Mibeit kodshei kodshim. Wow, and where did Haman get it from? From the Holy of Holies. Part of the spoil of the temple. That's interesting. We hadn't seen that before. Gavoh hamishim Haman is 50 amos high, very tall, 100 feet high. Shenema vetulam. This is taken from Malachim. Again, another thing that we learned once upon a time when we all the measurements of the height of the first temple, and there were literally beams of wood which were 100 feet long. Miyad siva hamelech litloto, and the king said, "Hang him." Shenema talu alav lekayim mashikila loto dariyovish. And later on, and this is an intro into the book of Ezra, Mitzvah Hashem, if we get there, where Darius says. And it's again, it's in Aramaic. Yid nasach o min beito zakaf, whatever that is. In bracket, yisach eitz mi beito. Very difficult to read. That a wood should come from his house, zakaf yitzleolav, and stand it up to hang him upon it. In other words, there's the wood that Haman, on which Haman was hanged, was actually taken from originally from the temple in Jerusalem. That's again a very fascinating idea. And listen to this last line: the Omer of Pinchas Tzarech Lomar Charvona Zacholato. You have to give Charvona the credit. And again, all the rabbis are very perplexed. Is it credit or is it opportunism? He was an opportunist. He got himself out of a difficult situation. He brings it from the Torah Tumima that in fact Charvona. He talks about the tree being so high, whatever. And, he was almost as if he was bringing, he was bringing something down on himself because he knew all about this. He points straight at the tree and he says, over there. And the king could turn around and say, how do you know all this information? Were you involved with Haman in the preparation of all of this? In other words, maybe you're a conspirator as well as Haman. So a Charvona is in a bit of a tough corner here. Yeah.
Probably
nothing, but who knows?
He might have gotten swept up in the...
Yeah, and he might have also been killed as an anti-Semite in the reprisals.
What if a Nazi would have pointed out where Eichmann is? You would say, that Nazi did a good thing, so that's the same concept.
It's the same concept, yeah, and the question is, would you have given him some sort of... Immunity was given to Nazis who gave over... information after the war, about the Russians, because then that's why so many of them managed to run away from Germany and Ephraim Zuroff and the whole crowd have been chasing them ever since. Not many of them left, yeah.
Another idea about it is, I don't think Charvona was really on the scene. And it's probably like it was a few hours or whatever pause, and then when the words come out and things like that,
yeah.
Then Chavona is like showed up and things. Maybe Chavona's a whole lot of, because, you know, it was a big decision. It was like the biggest guy in the whole kingdom,
yeah.
Next to the Haman,
yeah.
Next to the king, and
yeah.
Then he's going down really bad. So maybe this was like the last push to really...
And just have the omets. He had the courage to say it.
Yes.
To stand in front of the king and say, you know, hang, this is a good opportunity to use the tree.
But because maybe you know, the king, he was very close to the king, was next to him, and then maybe the king has some kind of a doubt of what he just come out with.
Possible.
Chavona just came right in there.
Chavona rides into the story, and you know, that's it. He feels it. It's Yecholiot. There is a Derech like that. There's so many different Perusha. It's just fascinating. And I like that idea. Yeah.
Point out that we say the gum Chavona.
Yeah.
Chavona said gum he neha.
And that's the gum. Yeah,
so,
yeah.
We usually would say Chavona is a cholato.
Yeah, but gum. The gum of Chavona, right? The gum referring to Chavona is a cholato. But why that particular gum? Gum is inclusive.
Because that saying gum says, also, in addition, that was the thing that brought Haman down.
That brought Haman down, yeah.
Final knock on the...
Yeah, it was the nail in the coffin. Listen to that. I want to share with you a bit of Rav Lau on this, because he says something very precious. He says, it's unbelievable. What is Chavona, you know, why does he get this incredible praise that everybody sings about him? You know, it's not just that, you know, when we start dancing on Purim, it's Gam Chavona Zechol HaTov, everyone's dancing around praising this guy. So listen to this. This is section 2 on the page 2. Nasim Lev. Malka reckons, let's see what's going on here. The king's already decided that Haman is basically trying to overwhelm the queen. Kol mi shenimtza b'sviva mevin shehaman siyem et tkufat ha'adna shelo. In other words, Haman is finished. Everybody can see that. He's already been told by his wife and all of his friends, you've had it. You're already starting to fall. Achshav, now, rak benekuda zo, besipur megillah, this point, echad asarisim yotzei min aron, this officer comes out of the closet, mafilil et Haman, and he accuses Haman, vashomeo meit navoch, and we're standing there very confused. Hare ata charvona yodata kol hazman, you knew the whole time, shahaman, Mechinat Eitz Mordechai. Haman was preparing the tree. Why didn't you say something before? What are you waiting for? Arachshav shatakta rakka eight. Now, only now, you were silent so long, and only now you're speaking up. Kishabaru mi amanatzech. Now you know who's going to win. Ata mityatzev letzido. You're already beginning to become outspoken. Zui gvuratam shel aluvim. This is courage of people who are, you know, we would say in English, pathetic. Shall svoimd of people who are hypocrites. Vishel, here you go, opportunistim. People opportunists, right? This is what Chavona is. Et akriya hazo ani motze b'midrash chachamim. And in fact, Rav Lau quotes the same midrash that we saw just now. And says Rav Pinchas at the end of that midrash, that Rav Pinchas says, Chavona zachu latov. And listen to this, go to the next column. Kulanu makirim. Et a tipus haze, he says, we all recognize this particular type of individual. Kesheshalit bachar litalel bayudim. When any leader tries to bring complaint, some sort of attack on the Jews, ha-charvona haya rishon, the charvonas are the guys, she-zgir otam, who begins to hand them over. He's the one you thought he was your friend, and you know what? He's the first one to say where the Jews were hiding. Hiflilotam v'akol mitoch magama litzdayen. And of course he wants to shine. He wants to be outstanding in his work. Kesheoto shalit hitmotet. And when the leader falls down, hacharvona yirishon lirgom bobamanim. This is the chavona. He takes stones and he throws stones at the leader. He's literally, you know, on both sides. Now he says something beautiful here. Lamrot ha-devarim pshutim ha-elit, apart from these very obvious things, ba'echa mechachmei ha-midrash, Rabbi Pinchas, v'kava klal ha-dorot, Rabbi Pinchas says, gam charvona zachur latov. He is to be his memory is to be for a blessing. Why? Lamrot ishiutam pupeket shel chavona. Even though he has a very doubtful personality, this is what we've said, Hadarshan, this Rabbi Pinchas, Mevakesh Lachliloto B'toku Sata Tovim. Chavono, we want to put into the category of a good guy. Eile, one of the good guys, She'ein Lo Kiyam, Ola Kotam, Ela Yesh Lechabdam L'Shabcham. We want to praise him. But the question is why? Zechuto Shal Chavono Omedet Lo B'Shalom Milim, Gam Hine Oitz, and that's the gam. He said, there's the tree, also there's the tree, so this is the gam. He uses that anger, that moment of anger of the king. And he brings it to a conclusion. The king is angry, the tree is over there. I've got an absolutely good way of getting out of trouble. I'll make sure Haman is put on that tree and is hanged. The king says, hang him. You're right. Good idea. In such a topsy-turvy place like the court of Achashverosh, if Shari Gam Tarchish, it would happen, Shebo HaMelech Mitztanei Mika'aso, the king might have cooled off, Umachalit La'roget Mordechai, and might have decided to kill Mordechai instead. Who knows what he was going to say? Vet Esther, and he would have killed Esther. You know, this is a king that you can't attribute to him any logic whatsoever. Lama, why? Kacha, he would have said Kacha, it might have happened like that. Ba Charvona Ishara says, so this evil man Charvona comes along, Umasayeya Lamimush Hasofiyut Shalamikrim, brings about the end of all of these events, Hamitapchim Bamegillah, which are turning over and over in the Megillah, Bizachuto Nitle Haman Istaimar Parsha, Vakena Medra Zucheto Latovasa. He's mentioned for good because he is part of the catalyst to end the decree against the Jewish people. Now, what he says now is unbelievable. He says like this, what is this really coming to teach us? Yitachen she'alekach, what is the real lesson? And I really like this. Sh'Rabbi Pinchas v'akesh lamed b'midrash chashuv yoter mimachavona atzmo. He's trying to tell us something more important than chavona. Ha'ayinu rotzim lirot et ha'gula. When we look at redemption, at the end of the day, we're going through the process of saving, being saved. We always like to think that when we are being saved, kol suk shagul, any type of redemption, ba'am in makom mushlam, always comes from a complete place. It's coming from a place, it's coming from a good place. We always think that it's the good guys and the bad guys. You know, we grew up with that mentality. Naki, mezukak, is coming from a clean place. Malei b'mesirut nefesh v'akrava, full of mesirut nefesh, and all of the values being prepared to give your life for the sake of redemption. All of this, we thought, should be the way that redemption comes about. In real life, it's always a bit grayer than that. All right, and I think he's talking about sort of the early redemption, the early yeshuv in Eretz Yisrael. The early yeshuv in Eretz Yisrael was made up mainly of irreligious Jews. And everybody was looking at that and saying, this is where the redemption is going to come from. This is Reshit Tzmicha Gulatena, when we've got so many people coming to work the land, but they're not keeping Shabbat, and they're not keeping the mitzvot. And the answer is yes. Rav Kook said it. Rav Kook said, you know, they excelled in the midst of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, but more to the point, redemption doesn't always come from such a holy source. He says, the chol maaseh mitztarfim kochot. To every action, there's always powers, he says, that are joined. Shemoniim im motivatio pratio, may even munaim, which are motivated, it comes from private motivation. Anashim mechashvim chishuvim pratim, people think of private calculations, their own ideas. Ach, bepoel, but in practice, not nin yad lecholel tshuah, they still bring about salvation. Even if they're doing it for the most selfish reasons. And this is, I think, so true. In reality, sometimes the way that we've got out of difficult situations has been from the most, you know, difficult and strange quarters. You know, there's so many stories of how the salvation came about, through circumstances, sometimes through people that we didn't expect to stand up for us, and they did, and you know, all these types of stories. And the Maharal has got a lot of stories from Prague, and there's stories all through Jewish history. It's always been like that. Haratzon liyot tahor, the desire to be pure. Hu nachlatam shanashim gvoim, it's the idea of elevated individuals. Ach lo masim, but not practical people. Hamasoret shel chavona zachulata. That's why he gets a bracha. He may have been the biggest lowlife in the world, and he may have been the worst person we could have ever have come across, but he stood up at the right time, and he made the right noise, and you know what? In the end of the day, Wow, he saved the certainly got rid of Haman, and that was how should we say 3/4 of the salvation. Yeah.
Could you also envision even the vessel to what Hashem was trying to do?
Correct, correct. There is this idea that he's a kli. He's definitely a vessel. Sure.
And it wasn't really himself who he is, because
he's. But the point is that God uses all different types of vessels. That's what he's trying to point out here, and it's not always going to be from the obvious source. You know, I'm just looking at the moment when you look at the Middle East and what's going on. I mean, this is so practical at the moment. You know, the countries which are stable are now not stable. All around Israel, everything is cooking, everything is boiling over. And yet, in Israel, you've got this oasis. You know, all right, it's always a busy country, but you know, there's democracy is flourishing, and the economy is sort of doing well, and everything else. And around, you've got complete chaos. And sometimes you say to yourself that even the salvation, wherever it's going to come from, may come from the most unobvious place, right? Not an obvious place. Who knows? Mr. Kerry may in the end turn out to be the best thing that ever happened to Israel. I mean, I hope he is. But I'm not quite sure at the moment whether that's the case. You know, they're not very happy with it. Okay, he keeps coming back like a bad penny, they keep saying. You know, they're not too excited with him visiting all the time. But who knows? Maybe Mr. Obama becomes the best president for the whole history of Israel since the beginning of the state of Israel. We just don't know. But that's the message, Chavona Zacholata, that we've got to be prepared to see beyond the obvious, and who knows where the salvation is going to come from. And it's an unbelievable idea, this. And we sing it on Purim. We recognize it. That's part of the Yeshua, part of the salvation. It's a fantastic idea.
So
go on.
Happened to be in the right place at the right time. Maybe he's there at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of a sudden he said, oh yeah, he was going to hang water.
Yeah. But again, Chazal play him into so much of the plot. Previously, he was behind the scenes and he was involved with all the negative stuff. You know, this is an opportunist. This is what Rav Lau says, opportunist. Big time. And I think, you know, when you think about it, it makes more sense to look at him like that. Fascinatingness, yeah.
That's what they say.
And he's definitely Esther. And that's the whole message of Purim. Esther Minayin has Aster Aster Bonayin. The whole name Esther is the idea of hidden. God's salvation comes through a hidden source. Yeah.
Is it possible that Harbona was Jewish and he saw Esther and he came out and said, you know,
I have a feeling not. That's stretching a point. I have a feeling it's a real stretch, but if you find a source that says that, please show me. I'd be very fascinated.
I'm just a question.
I hear you. I hear what you're saying. Before we just end, I just want to show you back on the first page, and I'm not going to go through it, but there is a whole midrash here about the tree. There's a whole discussion about all the different trees in section C. The discussion is about on which tree was Haman going to be hanged. And all the different trees said, I want to be the tree. All right, the Geffen, the Etrog, etc., etc. In the end, the tree that was chosen was the thorn tree, whatever that is. A tree full of thorns. And it said that let the thorn come and be hanged on a thorn tree. Okay, this is the idea that even in nature, right, things which look to be sort of things that we can't use, in the end have their place, have their purpose at a certain time, and serve our needs, certainly when it comes to getting rid of our enemies. And I noted at the bottom here, reminding me of the story of the stones. Jacob's head should lay on, you know, so all the stones started having an argument. So in the end, it became one big stone. You know, sometimes the rabbis go to extremes to show how nature, this is the point you made before with Chavona, how nature works in tandem, right, with history, with events, in order to bring about the salvation of Am Yisrael when it's required. And that's a very, very comforting point. Okay, and let's hope that even maybe now with such cold weather, maybe there is a reason for this deep freeze. Who knows? Something bigger than we can imagine. But hopefully it ends soon. Mitzvah Hashem, next week we'll talk about Perichet. The big issue that we have to deal with is what happens next. Because all we're hanging Haman, but what about the decree? The decree is made. And in Persia, once a decree is made, it cannot be cancelled. So it's all very well getting rid of the Baldova, getting rid of Haman, but what do you do now with the decree? The decree is to destroy the Jewish people, and that's going to be a very challenging subject. As you'll see, that's really the whole focus of the next parak, the next two parakim, how the Jewish people dealt with that, how through Achashverosh, Esther very cleverly dealt with it, Mitzvah Shem, to be continued next time. A lot of very beautiful ideas to be continued. Thank you, everybody.